Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, you know I love lists.
I know. I was kind of glad you came up with a list today. We haven't done one in a while.
Yeah, it's of course it's top 10 lists. Mm-hmm. And it's 10 things that people need to know how to cook.
Yes. There are a lot of things that people need to, some foundation stuff. But yeah, we can easily come up with a list of 10 things.
And 10 things that you need to know about wine terminology, wine words.
Mm-hmm. Are the words going to be scary or just informative?
I'm hoping they're just great.
All right. Okay. Let's get to it.
I put a few things on a list of things to have to cook, but mm-hmm. I'm interested in your list. So give me some stuff.
All right. So I think, you know, just knowing how to make a basic vinaigrette is an absolute must.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if my family, when they come over and I make a salad, first of all, they're always surprised at, like, how quickly I can make something, which I'm like, well, you know, I do this for my living. But I've been cooking a long time. But, you know, just knowing how to make a basic vinaigrette, it's simple. And there's no reason to buy anything, you know, I mean, to buy a prepared one if you don't want to.
People put a ton of stuff in salad dressing.
Mm-hmm.
A ton of stuff.
It doesn't need it. All you need is a good vinegar, mustard, and a good oil. And quite frankly, if you don't want the strong, you know, extra virgin olive oil has a lot of flavor. It's the first pressing of the olives. So therefore, it tastes a lot like olives, or exactly like olives. And so you can, you know, you can always cut extra virgin with corn oil, or if you'd like.
Canola oil.
Canola, or grapeseed oil, any of those, whatever you like, that's what you should have in your pantry. And the thing about that is just keep it in a cool place, and you can keep them for like 6 months.
So give some people some basic proportions, because I'm going to induce a lot of fear right now.
Okay.
Read the back of a prepared salad dressing, the ingredients in a store, and you'll always want to make your own.
Okay.
So pay close attention.
I like the idea of making your own. So I say 4 to 1. So 4 times oil to 1 part vinegar, right? So, you know, 25%, 75%, however you want to look at it. And then you only need a little bit of creamy Dijon style mustard. And you only need, you know, for 4 people, you need 2 teaspoons or a tablespoon. Let's say a tablespoon. A tablespoon. I have never measured this, but I do know the ratio. I just make food. I don't think about anything anymore, right? But let's just say a tablespoon.
I'm going to suggest that you're heavy on the mustard.
A tablespoon is heavy?
I think.
For 4 people?
I think so.
Oh, well, whatever.
And I love mustard.
Okay. So a little bit of mustard in the bowl, and then you whisk the vinegar into that mustard. And that's the first step. So first, to make the emulsion, which is what you want to make, you want the oil to cling to the vinegar and be solid, not separated. So you whisk the vinegar quickly into the Dijon mustard, and then you drizzle in your oils. If you're only using extra virgin or using 50% extra virgin and 50% corn oil or using all grapeseed, whatever it is, just whisk it in. And, you know, you really don't need that much dressing for 4 people.
So what's number 2 on your list of things people need to be able to cook well?
Chicken breast. And I think, you know, if you're going to saute it, you just need a stainless steel pan, heavy bottom stainless steel pan, get it nice and hot, a little bit of corn oil in the bottom of the pan, wash off the chicken breast, pat it dry, make sure it's dry before it goes into the pan, sear it on both sides, on one side a little bit heavier, get a nice golden color on the top side of the breast, flip it over, pop it in the oven, and I mean, there are a million things you can do to that chicken breast, but you want to sear it nicely, and you want to cook it until it's just done. You know, you want to cook it through, but you don't, if you overcook it, it's just going to be dry. There's no fat there. So
and you can
just
use a thermometer to check temperature.
Sure.
In the thickest part, you want to be 170 degrees or beyond, right?
Mm-hmm.
To be totally safe. When to salt and how to salt a chicken breast so that it's correct?
I do salt a little bit before, but I salt after. And particularly if I'm slicing it, then I definitely, when I slice, I lay out the slices and I gently salt each one and a little bit of pepper. But you can always do a marinade ahead of time, and you can salt it a little bit ahead of time. Just don't salt it heavily.
And chicken breasts are lean, so if you are going to slice it, you want to rest it for a few moments.
Absolutely, any
piece of
meat.
Before you slice it, so you don't lose all that juice. Mm-hmm. Let it actually, just like any other piece of meat, you want to let it rest.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I really think you know, you need to know how to make is a stock.
Let's talk about chicken stock.
Okay, chicken stock. I like a brown chicken stock, so I take my bones and I roast them in the oven and at 375 degrees until they're nice and golden. And then I remove all the fat from that pan and discard it. and then it goes into a stock pot. You cover it with cold water. You add mirepoix, carrot, celery, and onion. I add bay leaf and peppercorns, probably, you know, for, let's say, the bones from 6 chickens. Probably 1 onion, half a head of celery, and 4 carrots, all in a large dice. 10 black peppercorns, 4 bay leaves, that's fine. Cover it with cold water. Cold water allows the impurities to rise to the top in the form of scum, which you then skim off, and fat will also rise to the top, which you want to skim off. So once it comes up to a boil, skim it, and then bring it down to the lowest simmer. It should be one bubble breaking the surface every second. Let it go for several hours, I would say 4, and then you know, cool it down, strain it, cool it down, and you have beautiful chicken stock.
Okay, how about number 4?
Rice is a big one for me because there are lots of different types of rice. So let's just talk about something that's very accessible, which is Uncle Ben's rice. And when you go to cook that rice, you saute a small dice of onion and butter, add your rice, coat it, and then add whatever liquid you're adding. Let's say it's chicken stock. If I want my rice to be a little spicy, I might add a little bit of Tabasco.
Conveniently, you just made chicken stock.
Exactly, salt and pepper. And you cover, this is what my chef always told me when I worked in Charleston, the water needs to be above the level of the rice, 2 fingers going horizontally. That's the perfect measurement of how much liquid is in there. Once that comes up to a boil, put a lid on the pot, turn off the heat, set it on the back of the stove, and just let it go until it's done. But once it's done, you need to get it out of that pot because it will continue to steam and overcook. So if you're making it ahead of time in particular, which I almost, you know, we always make our rice ahead of time at the restaurant, you want to slightly undercook it. That way you have room to heat it back up again. And I just heat it back up again and a little bit more chicken stock. And I always add a little butter because I like butter in my rice.
You like butter and everything.
I do. Not everything, but I like butter. Butter is a wonderful thing.
Uncle Ben's is long grain rice. Mm-hmm. That's a method for long grain rice. Short grain rice are things like arborio rice or risotto, mm-hmm. or la bomba rice for the Spanish arroz.
Mm-hmm. And I use la bomba. Coming from Spain, it's you can actually buy it through La Tienda. You can actually buy that wholesale on the internet. T-I-E-N-D-A, La Tienda. They have a lot of great Spanish products, and they're out of Northern Virginia, so they're not that far away from us. To make risotto, the difference is when I just told you how to make the rice, the Uncle Ben's rice, you put all the water in the pot, you know, you let it come up to a boil, you put a lid on it, and you put it on the back of the stove.
Well, your end goal is for it to be light and fluffy and separate.
Exactly.
But risotto
is creamy and not separate. It's a very different ball game.
You're doing the opposite thing. You're working the starch out of the rice.
Mm-hmm. And keeping it. working it out and it becomes a wonderful part of the dish.
And incorporating it so that it actually kind of is its own sauce.
Right. So the process with making risotto is you have your pot of whatever it is that you're going to add to the rice liquid-wise. So chicken stock, lobster stock, saffron water, whatever it is that you're using, that's in one pot. And then you have your other pot that you're making your risotto in. And I like a slope-sided pan to make rice in rather than a straight-sided pan. So that's
those big rounded rice pans that you can kind of
almost
flip it in is
exactly
great.
So again, start with onion. You could have anything else in there. I mean, I'm just giving you really basic things, but I mean, it could have shallot, it could have garlic, it could have fresh herbs in it, it could have, you know, anything in
there. Porcini mushroom.
Exactly, or asparagus, or anything that you want, however you want to make it. But the idea is you want to saute, and I always do shallots and onion in a small dice. So that gets sauteed gently in butter until it's translucent. I typically never get any color on that when I'm doing it. And then I add a little bit more butter to the pot, and then I add my rice, because what you're doing is you're toasting the rice at this point. It's like a minute. It's on low heat. You're not browning it. When I say toasting it, that does sort of suggest coloring it. You're not, it's called toasting it, but you're just cooking it a little bit in the fat, and then you immediately begin to add the liquid to the pot. And the first bit of liquid that goes in is the most important. So if you want to add lemon juice or Tabasco or rosemary or any kind of an herb or, you know, jalapeno peppers or whatever, add it from the beginning unless you're concerned about it losing color. You add that first bit of liquid and make sure it has salt in it. Make sure it has pepper in it. Make sure it's well seasoned, because it's that first bit of liquid that rice is going to absorb is so important. And people like season at the end. No.
Well, it doesn't all absorb at the end. That's
exactly.
The thing.
So add that. And then as you see the liquid start to come down where there's nothing really on top of the rice, then add more liquid. So this is the process of risotto. And it's really, you know, basically when the risotto is as tender as you want it to be, that's when it's done. Get it out of that pot and either eat it or, again, cool it down in a big, you know, cookie sheet or hotel pan or, you know.
All right. So now we get rice covered. What's next on your list?
Number five is braising or stew. You know, how do you make a stew? Because I think everybody should know how to make a stew. So let's braise
something. So let's hear beef stew.
Yeah, let's braise something that's accessible once again, which is beef stew. So the first step is your meat, you know, obviously nice and fresh and wonderful, whatever it is. It needs to be dry. So just
a good cut.
It doesn't have, that's what's great about braising is it's an off cut. It's, you're not braising beef tenderloin, or you're braising something like a short rib, or, you know, any kind of, actually short ribs are a good example. They are not inexpensive, but they have bones and lots of fat and cartilage, and which makes for a great sauce. So let's just do short ribs. So you pat the short ribs. If you're doing short ribs, you're going to need a big pot, and you need a wide, when I say that, you need a wide surface in order to sear the meat, and you do not want a high-sided pot. So actually what you need is a very large saute pan, or you do it in batches. So you dry the short ribs just with a paper towel, and then you have your pan has to be extremely hot just to the smoking point. The oil has to be a high flash point oil like corn oil, canola oil, and you get your pan hot, put your oil in, you see the ripples in the oil, you know you're hot, and then you start to sear your meat. Do not overcrowd your pan. That is the biggest problem with trying to sear something. If you just cram every inch of that pan covered, but you want it to be almost all covered. I'm not saying put two in there. I'm saying put six, not 12 in there. So, you know, you want to cover almost all the surface, but leave a little bit in between.
You want the ratio of the ratio of pot to meat needs to be heavy on the pot side.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there's not enough heat in the metal to actually sear all the meat properly.
Right.
It won't recover.
It won't recover. That's the biggest problem.
It won't recover once you put the meat in there.
Yeah, because you're putting cold product in. You're not putting, you know, meat that's been sitting out for 5 hours. Yeah, and that's what I said earlier. Yeah, you can also sear it in batches. So you might as well have a sheet pan or something on the side or a container that you can put these short ribs in as you begin to sear them. So you start searing them, you sear them nicely and nice and brown on both sides. This should not have salt on it. This should not have anything on it other than it should be dry. So it goes into the pan, you sear them on both sides, put them over to the side as you're doing your business. And then the really fun thing is knock that fat, because that fat's going to be really brown and kind of overused by the time you're done. Knock that fat out of the pan. You don't have to clean the pan. Just get rid of the fat and immediately put some fresh fat in the pan and let it work in the pan for a second. And then put your mirepoix in, because all that fat, what we call the fond, the stuff that's stuck on the bottom of the pan, is so good. If the oil looks good, use it. But if it's really, really dark, just get rid of it. And let mirepoix, the carrot, celery, and onion just kind of work for like 3 or 4 minutes in that wonderful, you know, juice and all that goodness. And kind of scrape some of that stuff off the bottom.
And those vegetables steam out a little bit, which they need to.
Yeah, exactly. And then just put the short ribs back in. And obviously, you need to be like an inch above the level of the short ribs with your stock. And again, you can use the chicken stock you made. Hopefully, you made a chicken and veal stock, which will be a little bit more appropriate for this dish.
And it's got a little more of a base note.
Mm-hmm. And you can add red wine to the pan, which, you know, you can add a little bit of fresh rosemary, very little, keyword, a very little bit of thyme, whatever you like, or nothing.
If you're going to add wine, you need to deglaze it right before the stock goes in.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about what that does.
So deglazing also pulls off the fond off the bottom of the pan. So it gets all that wonderful stuff off the bottom, which creates tremendous color and flavor in the sauce in the end. And the acid from the wine cleans up the pan really nicely.
You don't need a ton of wine. If you have six short ribs, you need what?
What, half a cup? Yeah. Maybe 3/4 of a cup. That's probably too much. Half a cup of wine is fine. And then you could put a couple of bay leaves in and peppercorns. I would suggest that, even if you don't put any other thing in there besides, you know, the stock, I would put, 10 black peppercorns and maybe 4 bay leaves in, 2 bay leaves, 6 bay leaves, depends on how much you're making. And a little bit of tomato paste is nice, too. That's another thing you can put on the bottom of the pan before you, kind of lose all that good stuff off the bottom before you add the stock. A little tomato paste. That's up to you, though.
So once you have the stock covering everything,
it comes up to a boil. Immediately, you have to pay attention. Immediately turn it down to a low simmer And again, you have to keep that level of liquid, you know, an inch or so above the level of the product. And you should really put a lid on it. Now, you can either leave it on your stovetop, which I like because moving it around, it tends to be heavy.
Well, it's also a little dangerous.
It's a little dangerous, exactly. And but you could put it in your oven if you needed your stovetop for some other reason. You know, maybe you want to make lunch and, you know, you don't want this big pan on your stove.
So because you're going to be doing this a lot longer than
Yeah, it's going to take like 4 hours. You know, it's going to take between three and it depends on how big the short. It all depends on how big the short ribs are, or whatever it is that you're braising, but it could take up to 2, 3, or 4 hours.
So how do you know when they're done?
Tender, you know, almost falling off the bone or falling off the bone, depending on what it is. But you just, I mean, it needs to be like you put a fork in it. You're like, oh yeah, it's just, you know, you don't want it falling apart like to the point where it's like totally disintegrating and you've lost all the flavor in the meat. You just, once it's tender, and you'll see if you check it like at 30 minutes and in an hour, you're going to see how hard, it, you know, firm it's tough it still is. You'll see a change. So if you just like check it every now and then, if this is the first time you've ever done something like this, then you'll get a sense of, oh yeah, now look at it.
So when we come back on Formidable Phone Food and Wine, it'll be the rest of our top 10 list of things you need to know how to cook and 10 wine terms you need to understand. All of that and more on Formidable Phone Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
So doing the 10 things you need to know how to cook. So the first five, Cindy, were?
Stock, rice, braising, vinaigrette, and chicken breast.
And that rice is a twofer. It's both long grain rice and risotto.
Exactly.
And then here we go.
All right. Fish.
So number six.
The biggest thing about fish.
Cooking fish.
Is cooking it correctly, meaning sear it nicely if you're sauteing it. Grilling, getting good grill marks on both sides, cooking it evenly.
So pick one, searing it or grilling it?
Searing, rockfish. Skin on, you know, hot. This is exactly where you use your steel pan. Nice and hot. You can get that pan seriously hot. Back it down a little bit. Put your oil in it. Again, dry fish, paper towel it. The fish goes into the pan, skin side down. Have your fish spatula ready to go. You need to have one or some sort of spatula and gently hold it down in the fat. And what that will do is it will evenly sear it and the skin will get gorgeously crispy.
So instead of having a bow up in the air.
Right, because it will. Because when you put it down skin side first, it will bow. And then once that's gorgeous and, you know, really going forward, and then flip it over onto the other side.
How do you know when to turn it?
Once the top side is nice and seared and brown and goldeny brown, I mean to say, and the skin is crispy, then you can flip it over and sear it just for like a minute on the stove and finish. If it's a big fat piece of fish, put it in the oven to finish. And we do a small portion, but let's say you're doing a 6 ounce piece of fish. That's pretty reasonable for home. You're searing it probably 2 minutes on one side, popping it over 2 minutes on the other side. You're probably right about 3 to 4 minutes, maybe five in the oven. And one of the other things I'll do is if I'm, and you're in a 350 degree oven, you don't want a 425 degree oven. If I'm doing that right near the end, I may put a little bit of butter and fresh lemon juice with the fish as well, just to give it a little bit more, but make sure it's seasoned well as well.
And then you pull it from the pan, blot it.
And eat it.
Yes. All right.
All right.
Lucky seven.
Lucky seven is ceviche. So while we're on the fish mode.
I love ceviche.
Oh, me too. And there's so many different ways to make it, but let's do shrimp. So since we just talked about fish, let's do shrimp. So I buy small shrimp. Really, 26, 30 count shrimp are perfect.
That's 26 to 30 shrimp per pound.
Yeah. You rinse them, take the shells off, completely take the shell off, take the vein out, and cut them in half horizontally. And as I'm doing that, I go into a bowl that has ice underneath it, so it stays very cold the whole time. And once I'm done peeling and deveining and cutting in half the shrimp and cutting them in half horizontally, then I want to wash them. And I wash them 2-3 times in cold water, really cold water. And it just kind of cleans them up really nicely.
You're just trying to get the impurities out of the shrimp.
Right. And then they go into a clean bowl, and I immerse them in fresh lime juice. So once the lime juice is just like at the top of the shrimp, you're good. And I put a couple tablespoons, depends on how many shrimp you're doing, but you want to put salt in from the very beginning. And I use kosher salt. So it's in lime and salt right now. And it, you know, with 26, 30 count shrimp, it probably takes only about 30 to 45 minutes for it to really start to have the lime have its effect. At an hour, you're good for sure. And you don't want to over, marinate them in that lime juice, because they'll just cook, but it's not really cooking it, obviously, but it'll become the shrimp will have changed completely all the way through, and you don't really want that. So once you get to about 45 minutes, I have a very finely sliced red onion, cilantro, a little bit of habanero pepper, which is a very spicy pepper, so you know that's up to you as to how much you want to put in, and check for salt, and that's it, and it's just delicious.
So what's number 8 on your list?
Mayonnaise. So in order to make a good homemade mayonnaise, a little bit of fresh lemon juice, an egg yolk, and corn oil. And again, you can use other oils if you want to, but I'm just going to say very quickly, you whisk the egg yolk with the lemon juice and salt and pepper in a bowl. And you can always use a little pot with a towel on top of it and put the bowl in the pot. Obviously, this is on your countertop. I'm not suggesting that you're cooking this.
Yeah,
I'm just telling. It's a great way to do it by yourself. It's hard to whisk an egg, whisk the oil into the egg. The bowl will move all over the place.
You need a third arm.
Yeah. So if you want to do it by yourself, then you have your oil in a measuring cup, because one, you should probably measure it, and two, if you don't know what you're doing, and two, it again makes it easier to pour them from some huge gangly container. At the beginning, the first few drops that go in and the first aspect of making the mayonnaise is very critical, because that's when it may separate, which means that you will not be making an emulsion and it will be a big old mess. So once you've whisked the egg yolk,
let's not have a mess,
the lemon juice, the salt and the pepper, you know, it's whisked just to incorporate it. You're not adding air to it. And then you start to drizzle in the oil, and never stop moving while you're drizzling that oil in, and just keep going. One egg yolk can actually absorb one cup of fat, which is hard to believe. And it's, you know, you don't need that. Typically, I would say about half a cup of oil to one egg yolk makes a nice mayonnaise. But if it's not thick enough, just add a little bit more. Or if it's a little bit too thick, you can always add a little bit of cold water to it, you know, in droplets to thin it out a little bit. And that's mayonnaise. You can then, again, add anything you want to it.
So you just season it with salt or...
salt, pepper, lemon. And then, you could add anything to mayonnaise. You could add garlic, which is aioli. Or you could use olive oil, which is what aioli... aioli is made with not a first pressing of olive, but, a second pressing of the oil and garlic. And that's really what aioli is.
Okay. What's next?
A good salad. So we talked about making a nice...
vinaigrette.
Yeah, with lettuce, you know, you want the lettuce to be super fresh. You want to wash it well, keep it crisp, make sure it's dry. If you have a salad spinner, you can buy those easily for your house. Super, really, really suggest that, because you don't want water on your greens to ruin your vinaigrette or whatever accompaniments. And, you know, from different types of lettuces, arugula is a little spicy, to a butter lettuce that's sweet and tender, to escarole that's like crunchy fun and has lots of flavor. There's just so much that will be coming up at farmers market. So, you know, fresh local lettuce, or maybe you're growing it at your house. And then, you know, a little bit of julienne or diced cucumber, you know, chopped tomato or quartered cherry tomatoes, or, you know, anything in the world, fresh herbs that you want to add to it.
So step one, people need to know how to wash the lettuce correctly. Step two, they need to dry it correctly, right? So that the dressing will actually cling to the leaves.
Mm-hmm. You know, with washing lettuce, you want a big sink of water. It needs to be cold water. If it's not quite cold enough, just add a couple of ice cubes to the water. And in the summertime, our water tends to be kind of warm. And, you know, lift the lettuce out of the water, then drain the sink, then clean the sink, then add more water, and wash your lettuce until you see there isn't any dirt or anything at the bottom of the sink. And
if
then,
you just
and
wash
then
drain it. If you just wash it, sorry, if you just wash it in a colander, mostly... And I know that people will do this.
It needs to be immersed.
Mostly you're just running the dirt and sand from one leaf onto another leaf with the water.
Yeah, you need to have it immersed in water and allow the dirt to sink to the bottom of the sink.
And to dry it?
Just drain it as you're taking it out of the sink. I always shake it gently. You don't want to bruise the lettuce. Just shake it gently and then go into a colander, let that drain while you're working. And then when you're done, then pop it in a salad spinner. And that should be it. And, you know, my mom always put paper towels in with it. And, you know, you can do whatever you like to do, but you just want it to be dry.
Okay. And next on your list, number 10.
Hollandaise. Yes. I think
everybody should know
how to make hollandaise.
You love emulsification so much.
I do. Well, and that's kind of a
theme.
Three
of your 10 items.
It is kind of a theme, which is kind of an interesting thing to show you how important emulsion is and to understand how to make an emulsion.
Now, while a number...
And what you need to make an emulsion, which is acid and fat.
while a number of these we've done whole programs on a number of these items or in depth before, and you can find them if you're looking for podcasts on the Formal Wolf page on the WYPR website, WYPR.org. And it sounds like we're going to have to do an emulsification program in the future just to please Cindy. So, and all the people that love this stuff. So hollandaise.
The way that I make hollandaise is I melt butter, and you want to use a good quality butter. You want it to have a good amount of high fat in it. So this might be the one time you buy a reserve butter or some sort of special butter. And once that's melted, just let it settle. You don't want it to boil. Once it's melted, it needs to just turn the heat off and let it sit there for a second. It is 6 egg yolks per pound of butter to make hollandaise. So that's going to make a good amount of hollandaise, but that's the ratio. So now you know what it is. You need lemon juice, Tabasco, and salt. And you need a double boiler situation. So you need a bowl over a pot. This is on the stove this time. So your bottom pot has, let's say, a quarter or a little bit more of it full of water. And you want to make that hot. And then you, when you're ready to go, you whisk your yolks, you know, on the countertop, just whisk the yolks with a couple, you know, maybe like just a few drops of lemon juice, definitely a drop of Tabasco, no more than that, and a pinch of salt. And let's just get started that way. But whisk that. Now you can put your bowl over your double boiler, use a ladle. You need some way to really control that fat going in as you drizzle it in. I would use we use a 2-ounce ladle. And you need a good whisk, a nice, soft, big whisk that fits in the bowl properly, right? And as you're whisking your eggs, as you're using your other hand to drizzle in the butter with the ladle. And the butter should be warm. You don't want it boiling hot, but it needs to be warm. And if it's cold, that's not going to work either. So as you're whisking, you can't stop moving. Once you put that bowl over that double boiler, those eggs will start to hit. If they're not moving, they will start to firm up on the bowl. And you don't want your bowl, like, you're on low heat. That's another important thing. You want to be on low heat. That water should be hot already. And then you can be on low heat, because you don't want, if you have a gas stove, the flame could actually come up and hit the side of the bowl, and you're going to ruin your hollandaise. So as you're whisking your eggs, you're drizzling in your butter, and you're just going to start to see it thicken, 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 and then it's done.
What you're trying to avoid is going so fast that you get scrambled eggs instead of hollandaise.
You mean adding the fat too fast? Yes. Yeah. If you add the fat too fast, you will scramble. Yeah, heat will scramble the eggs, obviously, and adding too much fat will break the sauce. And, you know, you can try and bring it back with a little bit of cold water at the edge of the bowl. I mean, pretty much anybody in a kitchen can do that, but it's not the easiest thing in the world. But if it does break, at least try it. Cold water, a couple tablespoons on the edge of the bowl, whisk, 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 just what's right next to the cold water, and eventually incorporate the rest of it, and you may be able to save it if it breaks.
So those are the top 10 things you need to know how to cook.
Mm-hmm. Now we get to move to wine.
Okay, go for it.
So 10 wine words you need to understand. So the first one for me is tannin.
Okay, tannin, it's kind of linked to the first thing that I put on my list. The word that's used incorrectly most often in wine is dry.
Okay.
When you ask someone what they like, they often will say, I like a dry wine, or not too dry. What does that mean? When something is dry, it means that all the sugar has been converted to alcohol. So there's not actual sweetness there. It's dry, right?
Mm-hmm.
People often confuse tannins, which you're asking about, for something being dry. Wine with a lot of tannin can be mouth drying. Tannin is a type of acidity, and it can either be from wine that's aged in oak barrels, or tannins that come from, and some of the tannins actually sort of leached from the oak itself, from the wood. Also, the plant material, the seeds, the skins, once in a while the stems that are part of making the wine, and this is largely red wines, but there is some tannin in white wines, depending upon the white wine and just how thick the skins are, et cetera, et cetera. This is a compound, an acid compound, that has an effect. You'll be most familiar with it. The plant material gives you tannins right on the tip of your tongue and in the front. And that literally sort of dry your mouth and can be woodsy, grippy, that sort of sensation. And that balance out some of the natural, you know, effusive personality, fruitiness, all of that sort of business of the wine. The wood tannins you often can sort of get a sense of on along your teeth and the sides of your mouth. But they all work to sort of grip your whole palate. Thin-skinned grapes like Pinot Noir give you less tannin than thick-skinned grapes like Cabernet Sauvignon. for example. What's next?
Champagne.
Champagne. The immediate thing that comes to mind is champagne is like Kleenex. When I was a kid, if you wanted a tissue, you asked for a Kleenex.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you want sparkling wine, people say, well, I like champagne. Mm-hmm. Or the horror of horrors, they say, I don't like champagne.
Yeah, that is a horror.
Champagne is a place. Kleenex is a brand.
Right.
Champagne is a place that's famous for its sparkling wine. There are other sparkling wines made in many other places that don't very often go by the place names. Maybe they go by a brand. Prosecco is very popular now. That's a grape varietal in Northeast Italy that's made into a sparkling wine that people think of any sparkling wine as being like champagne, because champagne, frankly, is the most successfully marketed wine of all time.
Very good. Sulfites.
Sulfites. It's one of the dirty words of the wine industry.
That's why I think you should talk about it.
Sulfites come from, it used to be that wine would be harvested and had to be consumed almost immediately. More than 100 years ago, less than 200 years ago, it became a common practice for people to use a sulfur match and light that sulfur match and put it into a barrel so a little bit of the sulfites would literally burn off the match and be sealed into the barrel, and they'd close it. And that little bit act to preserve the wine that was in the barrel.
That's amazing.
One of the reasons that wine from Bordeaux will age is because someone figured out that's how you adding that little bit of sulfite. So that's literally all that, that's all that is. There'll be a small amount of a sulfur compound added to wine to help preserve it so that it will actually age successfully. Instead of by the next year's wine, it's completely dead without sulfites. There are some wines that are sulfite-free that do a little better than that, but not much.
Okay. Number four, barrel aging.
Oh, just refer to barrel aging.
Yeah.
How convenient.
Okay, good.
So barrel aging is something that's done for a couple of different... One, it's typically oak barrels. Balsamic vinegar is also barrel-aged, but traditionally that's chestnut barrels, juniper barrels, oak barrels, cherry barrels, all kinds of stuff. Wine is typically oak barrels. And it could be a couple of different things that are going on. Your choice with oak barrels is those big ones, the botti, or small ones that the French call barrique. And sometimes the barrique are new oak, which have a lot of flavor. Sometimes they're oak with a year or two or three or four of previous usage, which have less flavor. But the first year is very significant. All of those things can tend to add that vanillin, toasty, hazelnutty, you know, almost like pastry shop aroma that you can get in, say, California Chardonnay, where it can be pretty prominent, or in Bordeaux, or in Rioja, where the traditions use American oak as opposed to French oak, but there's oak from many sources around the world.
Okay, so let's go to some of yours. What's your number five?
My number five, complexity. See, here, this is one of those words that I think people often think of wine as a pretentious thing. And so someone, your resident wine expert person, will talk about how complex something is. What does that actually mean? Kool-Aid is not complex. It just tastes like what grape or whatever that might be.
Sure.
Listening to one instrument play one note is not complex. Listening to crazy seven-piece jazz band go in a million different directions is super complex and hard to keep up with. Listening to an entire symphony orchestra play a number of different notes in concert is very complex and can be very pleasing, especially if you like classical music. Mm-hmm. If your brain is processing all this, all that your senses are taking in, and it's making you remember all kinds of different sense notes that you have from a million different experiences in your life, when you're able to actually focus on the flavors that are there, You're getting a lot of input from your brain as to what something actually tastes like. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's when something is complex, it's giving you this big picture. It's making you, like a great piece of music, it's making you see something or think of something or telling you a story. Something that's not complex is telling you, this is the porch, this is cold, I like it.
All right, I like that.
When we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food and Wine, we've got a few more wine terms to run through. And then the Deadly Chef's Challenge. All that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
I'm Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we just ran through our list of 10 things you need to be able to cook, which are
vinaigrette,
chicken breast,
stock,
rice,
braised beef,
fish,
ceviche,
mayonnaise. No one wants to say mayonnaise, but it's the truth. You need it.
A good salad.
And hollandaise.
Yeah. Yeah, that was fun.
We're halfway through our list on wine. Wine terms you need to understand were tannins, dry, sulfites, barrel aging.
Champagne.
And champagne.
And complexity, which was interesting, Tony. So how about next one is varietals?
Varietals, okay.
Versus geographical labeling.
Exactly right.
Cool. So, all right.
Those are the two ways. When you look at a wine label, they can be organized in one of two ways. Traditionally, since wine is European, honestly, Mediterranean, to be perfectly honest, Tigris-Euphrates beginning sort of thing, all of those wines are known as being from places. The commerce of wine began with wine being sold from different places. And there's always a tradition of growing certain grapes in certain places because it made more sense and the grapes were adapted well to particular sites.
Sure.
So the wine would be from Bordeaux, and you would see Bordeaux on the label as this leading characteristic. Or even the village in Bordeaux, like Saint-Julien, say, for example. And then the people who would study about wine would learn that this house plants 80% Cabernet Sauvignon and 20% Merlot in their vineyard sites in Saint-Julien. In the New World, you largely see varietal labeled wines because they don't have as long of a tradition. And we took and replanted a bunch of cuttings from European vineyard stock. So that same Saint-Julien Cabernet Sauvignon, that some of that stock would be planted in Napa Valley, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But those wines would get to be known as Cabernet Sauvignon, or as Merlot, or as Chardonnay, or
so
as Zinfandel.
So by its varietal name instead of by its regional
name.
Exactly. Okay.
And then some places in Europe have gone back to being sort of mixed or by varietal, like Pinot Grigio. Which is grown in a bunch of different places in Italy, but you know that by varietal name.
Yeah.
So, but every wine is usually labeled in varietal name or geographic origin.
Okay.
And you kind of have to be able to go back and forth to know what you're talking about.
Okay. And what about, saying fruity or fruit-forward wine?
Wine is made from fruit.
What was that, number seven?
That is number seven.
Okay, all right. Number seven.
Wine is made from fruit. So it should taste like
fruit.
If it doesn't somehow taste like fruit, smell like fruit, there's probably something wrong with it.
Okay.
People get scared of wines being fruity. Don't mistake that there's a big difference between wine being sugary or sweet.
Good point.
And wine having attractive flavors from fruit. Wine should be fruit that has been turned into a product that translates the story of the season and the flavors of the place where it grew, if that makes sense.
Definitely.
And that's only done through the fruit.
Okay.
As wines age, some of those fruity characteristics tend to drop away, and you get more and more, referencing an earlier term, more and more complex flavors and aromas, secondary flavors and aromas that speak more of the place and a little bit less of the sun on the grape.
Okay, cool. And old world wines as a term?
Old world wines means usually European wines. Very simply, old world, new world. And I reference that when talking about geographically labeled wines and varietally labeled wines. It's funny, as soon as you think that your palate, that you like old world wines, only things that are pretty much labeled by place, you'll have a wine from the new world, because we've gotten pretty darn good at it, that tastes great and that is varietally labeled. And so that those terms go together to a large extent into helping you to understand where wine's coming from and what you might expect from what's in the bottle.
Okay, and I think we're at number nine, and I like this. If it grows together, it goes together. What does that mean?
That's a note about pairing wine and food. There are people who will tell you they only like red wine, or they only like white wine, or they only drink whatever, or I only eat fish, but I like red wine, things like that. When I first learned there were a lot of rules about exactly what had to be paired with what. And there was no way anyone was going to ever have fish with red wine and not be
back in the day
sneered at.
Right, definitely. I definitely remember that.
Last night for dinner, I had a beautiful piece of orata, the fish the French call durad, right? Seared exactly as you spoke about in the pan.
Nice.
With a little red wine reduction.
Oh, yummy.
With chicken stock in the reduction and nice mushrooms. They had a lot of flavor. And I had that with a Barbaresco, a red wine from northwest of Italy. 30 years ago, that would have had me attacked by a crowd on the street.
Right, and that's not a little shy red wine.
No,
either.
It's not. It has a lot of flavor.
It's a serious wine.
But that fish has a lot of flavor.
Definitely, with that prep.
So when you're matching wine and food, you're matching intensity, you're matching acid, you're matching fat content to tannin. Tannin and acid act to clean up richer things in your mouth, refresh your mouth, and make the fruit of the wine come out and be really attractive, and also make you want another bite of the food.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So there's a bit of a balancing act or a dance. You know, trying to walk with one leg or, you know, it's a lot harder than two. Wine and food go together like that.
Okay. Number 10 is appellation.
So appellation just literally means where something is from. And there are lots and lots of those. On French labels, you see appellation contrôlée, appellation origine contrôlée, which means that there are rules about calling wine from the name of this place. If you're going to call it Nuit Saint-Georges, Bourgogne, right? The wine from the village of Nuit Saint-Georges and the designated vineyards around it, and a wine from Burgundy, that means it has to be harvested at a particular time at a certain sugar level. So potential alcohol is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And also the grape type. You can't grow Cabernet Sauvignon there and call it Nuit Saint-Georges.
And those are the requirements of Nuit
Saint-Georges. Those are the requirements of Nuit Saint-Georges.
That those people decided this is what has to happen.
Yeah, there's a big council of growers.
All the way down to like the way they prune the vines and everything, right? So there's all these requirements. Yeah.
Yes, okay. Exactly right. There is more and more appellation labeling in other places in the world that don't have some of the traditions in Europe. And you see that in California now. And you see versions of that in some parts of Italy that are not the northernmost areas that have much more controls in place, or many more controls in place. So here we are at the Chef's Challenge. I've been waiting all day for this.
I know, I'm so
and
excited.
Here is your amazing Chef's Challenge.
Okay, eggs, chickpeas, red wine vinegar, canola oil, figs, mint, chicken breast, skin on, lemons, onion, garlic, tomatoes, greenhouse, asparagus, hearty, spinach, rosemary. Mm.
Those are greenhouse tomatoes. That is not a greenhouse on your challenge.
I'm glad I don't have to cook a greenhouse. That would be hard to do.
Looking for a nice lunch.
Yeah, I like the chicken breast. So, all right, so we already talked about how to do it, so I'm just going to roast the chicken breast, saute it, and finish it in the oven with the skin on, get that skin nice and crispy. I'm going to hit it with some of that lemon right after it comes out of the pan, a little bit of finely chopped onion and garlic. Those greenhouse tomatoes are going to finish, and I will have already boiled my asparagus and cut it on into bias cut size pieces, probably like an inch, and I will add that to the pan at the end.
I thought for a second you're going to make a big salad. How was it?
Not yet. So that's a chicken dish. That's going to be great. And then the eggs. Ooh. All right. So this is the chickpeas need to be a salad. So I'm going to boil those in water with the rosemary that you gave me. And once those and a little bit of salt at the end. So once the chickpeas are tender, which by the way takes forever, I'll make a vinaigrette with the red wine vinegar and the canola oil you gave me. And the eggs. So actually, it's more of a mayonnaise. So eggs, vinegar, red wine vinegar, and the canola oil. I'm going to garnish the chickpeas with the figs and the mint, which would be seriously good and interesting. And I'll do a chiffonade. You gave me hearty spinach. I'll just chiffonade that and add it to the salad at the end. And et voilà, salt and pepper. There you go.
A nice lunch.
How do you like that, Tony?
I'd like that with a fat glass of rosé. Thank you very much.
Okay, rosé.
All right, let's see. Pork short ribs, avocado, onion, shallot, garlic, rosemary, thyme, cilantro, tarragon, chervil. Having an herb party. Lemons, lime, asparagus, calamari. Dandelion greens, mustard greens. Strawberries, milk, cream, butter, olive oil, brown sugar, cornmeal, flour. Okay. Good Lord. I've got no stock to braise pork short ribs, so I'm gonna grill these pork short ribs. I'm gonna rub them with rosemary and garlic that you gave me, and a little bit of lemon juice, and I'm gonna marinate them for a little bit, and then I'm gonna grill these guys, let them get marked up really well, and then finish roasting them in the oven. You know, I may add a little bit of that brown sugar to that marinade just for fun. Mm-hmm. The pork short ribs will be in the oven for a long while. Honestly, I like
to grill.
I did grill them, and then I put them in the oven.
Oh, now you're finishing them in the oven. All right.
Finishing them in the oven, because I don't want they're going to have good fat. And
Yeah.
I want them to roast until they're done. In fact, I want to roast them a day ahead.
Mm. Wow.
So they can...
This is a long chef's challenge.
This is a long chef's challenge. I'm taking my time. You know I'm long time in the kitchen.
Nothing wrong with that.
So then the next day, get them hot again in the oven, but let the flavors actually set and get a good crust on the outside of those short ribs. That's kind of the goal that I was after. Mustard greens, dandelion greens, calamari. Calamari, I'd want to marinate same day in garlic, lemon juice, chervil. Grill that, and a little bit of lemon juice, I said. Grill that, rest it for a moment, slice it into rings and the tendrils. Put that in a saute pan with all the juice from the cutting board and just keep that warming a little bit. And kind of the calamari kind of relaxes like that. And serve that over a salad of the dandelion greens. I need to make a vinaigrette for the dandelion greens with more of the chervil and some tarragon that you gave me. A little bit of shallot in the base of the vinaigrette. Did you give me? Now I have to use just citrus for the vinaigrette with olive oil and lemon and a little bit of lime. All right, cornmeal flour. I do have dairy. I can make little cornmeal cakes with the dairy and with the cornmeal flour, make them sweet if I have a little bit of sugar. And so I'd have a dessert there with the fresh strawberries and little warm cornmeal cakes.
You're going to garnish that with the avocado?
No, you gave me cream, so I'm going to do whipped cream.
Okay.
The avocado, frankly, I'm going to lay out the avocado and serve that with the pork short ribs. I think some of that pork being pulled off the bone.
That would be good.
With a slice of avocado and a little squeeze of lime juice and some cilantro.
Yummy.
Probably pretty darn nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I used all your stuff except for the asparagus. So I'm going to add that to the calamari dish. I'm going to grill those at the same time.
Good.
That's strong flavors for both. That'll make sense. Use a little more garlic.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. So there we are. And I think that's all we have time for. If you'd like to download this or any other podcast of Foreman Wolf episodes, please go to the WYPR website. Look on the Foreman Wolf page, and you can find this and all kinds of other episodes there. If you want to contact us via email with questions, comments, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. On social media, if you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf,
you can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf or on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf.
On Instagram, I'm the real Tony Foreman. Thanks so much for listening.
And happy Sunday.